The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/PEL and enter promo code PEL. You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 144 is something like, should anger be accommodated by our political institutions? And we read Anger and Forgiveness, Resentment, Generosity, Justice by Martha C. Nussbaum, and are talking with her in studio today. This is Mark Lintonmeyer, cultivating my bare moral relations in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Alwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey at the University of Chicago in Chicago, Illinois.
And this is Martha Nussbaum at the University of Chicago.
We are beyond thrilled to be talking to you, and I've really enjoyed this book, I gotta say.
Oh, I'm so glad. It's funny because it's a painful emotion, but I'm glad the book was pleasurable.
Yes, it's very conversational, a lot of nice anecdotes and deep down analysis. It takes as its, well, it has a few launching points, but one of them that I especially appreciated was, yes, Nietzsche says a lot of things about how guilt, for instance, is how a lot of what we consider the foundations of morality are in some way psychologically negative. But you know, he just throws these things out. It doesn't have a lot of accountability.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You're actually being systematic about this stuff. So, Wes, Dylan, initial impressions, initial questions. How do we want to start?
Well, I thought we would start and maybe just talk a little bit about anger from the second chapter.
Wes, do you want to give us the quick version, since Martha doesn't want to have to talk everything and we should know this stuff too?
Okay, well,
I just wanted to hear Wes.
Martha can correct what I'm inevitably going to get wrong, but I take the thesis of this to be you define anger, and conceptually anger involves some concept of payback, which is a little bit different from revenge in that payback involves seeing someone who's done something wrong to some person or something else of significance, seeing them suffer. But it doesn't necessarily mean being directly involved in inflicting that suffering. So it could be, for instance, the state that does that.
Yeah, that's good. Can I start back a little bit further, though? Because
please.
I want to get the first part out on the table, the part of anger that I actually think is useful. Namely, the anger, is following Aristotle here, contains the thought that a serious wrong has taken place, that it was wrongfully inflicted, so it wasn't just accidental or inadvertent. And then there's this other part that's more problematic, namely that some sort of payback would be a good thing. And this is why Aristotle says that it's a painful emotion because there's pain in thinking about the wrongful damage to something that you really care about, but there's pleasure looking ahead to the payback. And exactly, it doesn't have to be you taking revenge. It could just be that you want the law to do it, or you want God to do it, or even that you just hope that that wrongdoer's life would go really badly in future, like the second marriage of your betraying spouse turns out to be a dismal failure. So that's the payback idea. It doesn't have to be you doing it. So that was good.
Yeah, I think also useful is your idea of target and focus, because these help distinguish anger from something like grief. So for instance, the target of anger is usually a person, and the focus is on the act, that the wrongful act itself, whereas grief would be on the damage. The focus would be on the damage done.
So you're angry at a person, but really the focus of that anger is the wrongful act. And that's very important in thinking about how we might move beyond anger in a legal system or also in personal relations. But with, of course, with grief, it's just the person who's gone. But I think another difference between anger and grief that's very important is that grief doesn't include a thought of wrongdoing. And so you can have grief and mourning even without being capable of causal thinking. We now believe that a lot of non-human animals have grief. And there's a whole book I was just reading recently about animals and grief. And, they do exhibit mourning behavior, and they seem to have the thought, someone or something really dear to me is forever gone. And that's true of elephants, it's true of dogs, it's true of many, many species. But it's less likely that those species will have anger, because anger requires complicated causal thinking. You have to think so-and-so did that, and they did it wrongfully, not just accidentally. So usually you would not think that young children have full-fledged anger. They might have a kind of inchoate rage, but they wouldn't have anger unless they were capable of that kind of causal thinking.
And so you're distinguishing abstract anger, or anger directed at an institution, from personal anger?
I think there's always a thought of sort of agent or quasi-agent who's inflicted the damage. Oh. But of course, you often think, oh, it's that lousy system that's caused me to be in the miserable position I'm in. And then when you're fighting a revolution, you often do personify. So the evil apartheid system is what I'm struggling against.
Yeah. I was just thinking of some of the times when I get terribly angry, and it reminded me of the fourth chapter of the book, had to do with a sense of not being able to control what was happening and being in the midst of like a bureaucratic nightmare. And so it's not even that the person who's the bureaucrat is the person that I'm exactly angry with. In fact, I have the experience of not being mad at them, but being mad at the situation that I'm in, that I cannot get you, meaning some amorphous entity, to understand this simple thing that I need to have done.
Yeah, well, very often, I think that's extremely perceptive of you, people feel helpless in a situation, and anger is a kind of deflection of that helplessness. Yes. It's not easy to feel helpless, but it's a lot easier if I can say, oh, someone's to blame and I'll go get them, or smash the system, you could also say. But I mean, suppose your parent has just died in the hospital. How many people say, I'm going to sue the doctors? And they do that often just because it makes them feel they have something to take charge of, something to be in control of. So that's a real political problem, that when people feel helpless, what they should be doing is trying to solve the problem. But what they all too often do is just think, oh, if I blame and harm somebody, then that will discharge the anger that I'm feeling. And often that's very irrational.
But you're making a point that it may not be rational, but an understandable aspect of it is the way in which it provides agency, that you feel like you're doing something. And that in some ways, especially the kinds of discussion you have about dealing with overcoming anger, seems like it involves a little bit of that not controlling.
I mean, sometimes, whether it's the end of a marriage or any situation that where you're really helpless, I think you just have to mourn and then move on. Now, in the political case, what you really need to do is look to the future, try to figure out how to make the situation better. But that's usually very complicated. Mm-hmm. It involves economic planning. It involves legal change. And so it's much easier to go out in the streets and riot and throw things because you feel like you're doing something.
Can we just back up and give a little bit of the philosophical context of the project, what you're trying to do here and the underlying theory of emotions that enables this critique to be possible?
The project really is a continuation of projects that I've been doing for many years. And this is one emotion that I hadn't spent much time on. I've written a book on disgust. I've written a book that foregrounds compassion and love. I've written another book that's largely about fear. So, you know, this is a part of a long-term project. And there is an overall theory of the emotions, but I don't rely on absolutely every part of it here. I have an appendix where I talk about that. My overall theory of the emotions says, first of all, and I think this is the non-controversial part, that emotions always involve some kind of evaluative appraisal. That is, you're looking at a situation and you size it up, whether through thought or through perception, as good or bad in some important way for you. And I think that's true of animal emotions as well as of human emotions. So it doesn't have to be elaborate, high-level thinking. The part that's more controversial is that the other aspects of emotion, such as physical feelings, physical movements, subjective feels, that those are too inconstant and not well correlated with a particular emotion type to be put into the definition of a particular emotion. So when people say that you ought to define fear, let's say, in terms of not just the thought of danger, but also some kind of trembling or shaking, my answer to that in the theory is that, well, you know, often that's there, but sometimes it isn't. We're all afraid of death. We go around every day, pretty much throughout our whole adult life, being afraid of death, and yet we're not trembling in our boots because we're not aware of that fear in a conscious way, but it is motivating what we do. And then I also want to say that people are very variable. Some people experience anger in connection with boiling feelings, and some experience it in connection with a headache the next day. So for those two reasons, I don't plug the feeling into the definition. But I leave that part out for the present book. I don't care whether you adopt my stronger view of the kind of appraisal theory or whether you adopt a weaker view according to which some feelings and physical movements are also part of the definition.
Right, but the important part is that there's cognitive content to an emotion, and that is the point that is open to critique. I mean, if you're Plato, you could just say emotions are these bestial things and reason has to control them, and that would be one way, you know, if you have a very simple view of emotion as feeling like that, and you could talk about different therapeutic techniques.
Yeah, but actually Plato didn't think that. Plato thought that the emotions, fear and the other shame and anger, were what he called the allies of reason because they responded to rational arguments. And they were to a large extent constructed by the literary works that you hear. And so they were in that way importantly different from appetitive desires. So I don't think you can find anyone who really holds a pure non-cognitive theory. I teach this every year and I keep trying to find somebody. I think Hume officially has a pure non-cognitive theory where he says that a passion is just an original existence, a feeling that you identify by the way it feels. But the minute he gets to talking about particular passions, such as pride and so on, it becomes altogether different. And Donald Davidson famously argued that Hume's theory of pride is a cognitive view, and I think he's basically correct. William James might have more of a pure non-cognitive view, but it's complicated, and I don't want to go into it here. And then when you get to contemporary people, Jesse Prince is the most salient of the non-cognitivists, but it turns out that he and I don't disagree very much, because what he means by cognitive, he has a very narrow definition of the cognitive, according to which something is cognitive only if it's a part of autonomous agency and in the control of the will. So, I mean, of course, I think cognition just means processing information. So if we adopted my broader, more inclusive definition of cognition, I think in the end, his theory is very similar to mine. So anyhow, I wanted to turn my attention to anger for two reasons, both because I hadn't talked about it much, but also because I really was not sure what to think about it. I had written some things that actually said, well, anger could be misguided if it gets the facts wrong or if you get the values wrong. Let's say if you get angry because somebody steals your toothbrush, that's pretty stupid because it's not that important. But I did think that in the big important cases, it was actually not only well-grounded, but it was productive. But I had not really analyzed it. I hadn't sat down to focus on the role of payback and on the role of this wish for payback inside anger itself. So when I ended up just sitting for weeks at my desk thinking about this and just thinking, is it really correct what Aristotle and all these other philosophers all through the Western tradition and also the Indian tradition say, namely that the payback wish is a conceptual part of what anger is? If that's true, then that changes what we want to say about anger, I think, because that payback wish, however evolutionarily programmed and therefore useful at some stage in our prehistory it might have been, it's really stupid. To, you know, kill somebody doesn't bring the dead back to life, and to visit a painful punishment on the wrongdoer Well, if it does good, that remains to be demonstrated. Sometimes painful punishments do deter future wrongdoing. Sometimes they reform the wrongdoer. Sometimes, at the very least, they incapacitate the wrongdoer. But we have to show that. And it isn't just in and of itself that proportional payback makes sense. So here I was agreeing with most of the Greek and Roman philosophers. Plato thought retributivism was a very silly position. He was in favor of a deterrent conception of punishment. Even before him, Aeschylus and the Eumenides. So the Eumenides, to be part of the city, they have to listen to the voice of persuasion and become rational. And that means stopping this mindless search for payback in favor of a search for what will promote general welfare. So anyway, that's what led me to feel that I really wanted to write a whole book on anger, and that it would be a book where I would be eating my words, because I really do have to take back quite a few things that I said, not at great length, but did say in other books.
Should we say something also about the role of status? Because your argument is that this idea of payback doesn't make sense. And one way of looking at anger, the payback wish, is this sort of irrational idea that payback will cosmically balance things out, or that it could restore what's been lost, when, of course, if someone has died, or what's been lost can't really be restored. But there is, you say, there's a sense of payback that actually does make sense, even though it turns out to be normatively problematic, as you put it, and that's status, yes.
Yes. Okay, great. Now, Aristotle has one part of his definition that no subsequent philosopher picks up on. I think they're right to reject it as part of the general definition, but it's still quite an interesting insight. And that is that he thinks that anger is always a response not to any kind of wrongful damage, but only to the kind that he calls a downranking. In other words, that it's always about relative status. And as I say, I think that can't be right. We get angry at things that don't involve that kind of humiliation or diminution. We get angry even at violations of principles of justice. But what's interesting about that case, and psychologists who study anger empirically show that it's a really very common case in lots and lots of societies, and certainly in America. And the interesting thing about that case is, it seems to me that that's the one case where payback gets you what you want. But if all you care about is relative status, then by pushing the wrongdoer relatively lower, you automatically do push yourself up relatively higher. And if that's all you care about, you don't really have to worry that the real issues caused by the murder or whatever have not been solved. However, what kind of person really thinks that way? Well, unfortunately, a lot of people do think that way, that everything that happens is about their relative status. And I don't think we can kind of push it off onto those distant societies that we call honor cultures. And we like to think that this obsession with status is someplace on the map of the world, someplace in the Middle East or some. But of course, in the U.S., that's very ubiquitous. And I have to say, in the academic life, perhaps even more than other places, people are scanning the internet for something that disses them. And so they're obsessed with their relative status. And, you know, to insult somebody who gives your book a bad review solves the problem only if it's a problem of relative status only. But it doesn't, of course, remove any real flaws your book had or make your work any better than it was before. So it's a very narrow set of values.
Can we say more what we mean by relative status? Just because it seems to me it's not just relative status in the view of others or in the view of the public. Status could involve, for instance, one's sense of efficacy or power. So for instance, if you feel humiliated by, and I think that this actually goes to this idea, and you know, that sort of related idea of narcissistic injury, and psychoanalysis actually goes to the core of what makes us angry. We're not angry at the loss per se, we're angry at its implications for status broadly conceived. So the way Nietzsche put, and I thought a lot of the genealogy of morals and reading your book, but the way Nietzsche puts it is that political superiority always resolves itself in the psychological superiority. So in other words, when we are victims, when we are damaged by others, there's a sense in which we feel it's our fault. We feel some sense of shame. We feel that we're actually bad people because on some really fundamental scale of values, we see our own power and efficacy as good things. And so the role of retaliation is to prove if in some sense the person who's damaged us has sort of offered proof of our own powerlessness and lack of efficacy, then we have to prove it again. And it doesn't have to be in the eyes of other members of the public. We, in a sense, have to prove it in our own eyes. I don't know how well that aligns with your point of view, but that's, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I tried to define it pretty narrowly, focusing on something more external, because I wanted to say there, if you're just thinking that society has this grade list, then by putting the person down from a C to a C minus, you relatively put yourself up, is the idea, if society is like grading on the curve the way we do here in the law school. And so that was my picture. Now, of course, you're right that there is a much more interesting, complicated form of that that is inner and requires looking for what the person is trying to achieve. I mean, I don't dwell on that in the book. It would have been interesting to do that. And I think you're right that it gives a different kind of deeper take on where the narcissism comes from. But it's also quite possible for people to be obsessed with status just because that's the way their society is. And I think when I'm thinking of these people in the academy who see everything in terms of who gets more salary and who gets more mentions, who gets citation index and so on, I don't think it's necessarily the case that those people are like Nietzsche's people who are moved by a profound sense of loss of agency. I think they're just conformists.
And but their sense of their value of themselves has to be tied to this. Like if their sense of value weren't tied to it, they would have no reason to jump from the point of view of others to anger, I think. Is that right? Or
no, that's certainly true. So it's only if you've put all of yourself into that basket that it becomes at all productive to engage in payback. That's what I wanted to say. But of course, to put all of yourself into that narrow basket, that seems very deficient and very narcissistic.
Before we go any further, let's take a minute to talk about our sponsors. First, I want to tell you about the Great Courses Plus. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you've heard us mention them before. Like the Partially Examined Life, it's great for people who want to keep on learning outside of the classroom. These courses consist of short video lectures given by award-winning professors on a really wide variety of topics, everything from philosophy to history to how to take photographs. And once you sign up for the Great Courses Plus online, you get unlimited access to all these courses that you can stream from anywhere, anytime, any device. The course I want to tell you about today is Neil deGrasse Tyson's The Inexplicable Universe. I recommend Lecture 6, Inexplicable Cosmology, if you're interested in things like multiple universes, antimatter, tachyons, quantum foam, and a discussion of the long-term fate of the universe, such as the collision of galaxies, the burning out of stars, the decay of orbits into black holes, things like that. There are 6 lectures in total, and they all focus on sort of the mysterious aspects of the universe. So if you're into that sort of thing, I recommend this course highly. And right now, as one of our podcast listeners, you'll immediately get a free month of unlimited access to all of the Great Courses Plus lectures when you sign up. To get a free month, sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's plus spelled out, P-L-U-S. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL.
This podcast is also sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly onto the consumers. Casper's mattress is an obsessively engineered mattress at a very fair price, combining 2 technologies, springy latex foam and supportive memory foam, to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and the right bounce. It's got a breathable design that sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature throughout the night. Several months ago, they sent me one. Super comfortable, no complaints. However, if you have complaints, it's totally risk-free. They offer free delivery and a painless return policy within a 100-day period. So you have 100 days to try it out, which is much better than just lying down something in a showroom. So try it out. Get a Casper mattress for $500 for a twin or $950 for a king-size mattress. Compared to industry averages, that's great. The mattress industry has forced consumers into paying notoriously high markups, but Casper is revolutionizing things by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms, passing that savings right to you. And you can save an additional $50 toward a mattress purchase by going to casper.com/PEL and entering the promo code PEL. That's casper.com/PEL, promo code PEL. Terms and conditions apply.
Happy August, PEL citizens. Ryan Wilson here to let you know about some upcoming seminars to help you ponder the existential issues of August, such as what is truth, what is virtue, or can I get away with liking Bud Light Lime? Our next Introductory Readings in Philosophy series seminar will be Monday, August 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, led by your humble narrator, on Albert Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus. We also have four more seminars scheduled for the fall listed in our Nut School Forum. We want to remind you of PEL's partnership with Adam Rose and the terrific folks over at Great Discourses. PEL listeners receive 15% off by using the code PELIFE, and PEL citizens 20% off at greatdiscourses.com. Lastly, we want to let you know that PEL has partnered with Dr. Greg Sadler at Reason.io to offer Not School seminars. Dr. Sadler's first seminar series will be on Hegel's Master-Slave Dialectic from Phenomenology of Spirit. To participate in any of these seminars, you simply have to become a PEL citizen, meaning pay $5 a month. And of course, it also includes the full-length ad-free versions of the entire PEL podcast back catalog. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me at brian@partiallyexaminedlife.com. Hope to see you at a seminar soon.
All right, now back to the show. So clearly a lot of what you're doing here is informed psychological deliberation. And you mentioned psychoanalysts like Winnicott, a guy that we'll probably cover at some point. And some of this comes from, we've had a couple episodes on stoicism and the way we've been talking about anger being generally a negative thing, all this pettiness of arguing about your status. And so it seems like the solution would be something that a psychologist should be talking about. How do I, in an efficacious manner, lessen anger within myself? But a lot of the work of this book is a conceptual analysis that happens before we actually get down to, you know, what you're going to do therapeutically every night. And just this division into these different spheres that you've got a chapter here, just to explain to the audience, once we set up what your analysis of anger, what generally is wrong with it, and forgiveness that we haven't yet talked about, it ends up that sort of the solution, the way that we evaluate what is legitimate and what is not in anger, is going to vary a lot in the different areas of intimate relationships on the one hand, and then what you call the middle realm, which is really people that you don't have a personal relationship with, but you have to deal with, whether at the workplace or on the internet or whatever. And then in the political realm, and each of those ends up having a very different take on how legitimate, you know, are apologies necessary? Are apologies helpful? To what extent could it be a deterrent? Is there any place in anger at all? Should we give a sort of a brief outline of how those break down?
Well, I think let's first say that in all three, okay, what I say is you get to a threefold fork in the road. Mm-hmm. You can go down this road of payback, in which case you're trying to achieve something that doesn't make sense. You're really deluding yourself with this fantasy of cosmic balance. Let's say killing the murderer will bring back or balance the death of the one you love. Or you go down the road of status, in which case you may possibly get what you are seeking, but it's a singularly narrow and unworthy objective. Or the third possibility is you turn to the future and you think in some intelligent way of what do we got to do to make things better? And that's what I call the transition with a capital T. And so I illustrate it in both personal and political ways. And so in the personal life, it would mean stop obsessing about the wrongs your ex did to you and try to figure out how to make a good life for yourself, which of course isn't always what therapists are directing you to do. So that's a problem. But anyway, in the middle realm, of course, in the workplace, there are many things that are irritating, but to make somebody stew for the insult they inflicted is probably going to make things worse in the long run. So what you have to figure out is, what is your relationship with that person going to be in the future? How could we actually make things better? And just thinking of payback doesn't really help that. But then in the political case, of course, that's where I spend most time, it's very, very important to turn away from the thought that just lowering and smashing the people who have wronged you is the way to get things done. And so I then focus on Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Mandela as examples of people who made this transition to forward-looking constructive thought and work, and they got their followers to do that too. So turning to the future is what all these realms have in common. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have to do that differently in the different realms.
Yeah. So for instance, for intimate relationships, I think you emphasize the importance of grief or mourning.
I am not a stoic. The reason it's important to distinguish the realms is that I don't think that a lot of these casual relationships are worthy of serious concern. So when somebody makes me mad on an airplane, and I do include many stories of my own irascibility on airplanes, you know, it's just not worth getting upset about, period. But in intimate relationships, I think it's very worth getting upset because these are deep parts of your well-being. You've invested trust and personal shared plans, and you've shared goals with this other person. And so, of course, a betrayal or a death, of course, those are quite different, would be a very profound loss. And you do have to deal with that, and you have to mourn. But all too often, instead of doing that, people get preoccupied with the backward-looking payback project. So divorce litigation, child custody litigation, prolonged therapy that focuses on my history with the ex and dealing with my angry feelings at the ex. And this could go on for 20 years, and it could make you no better off in your actual present and future. Because if somebody has been together with somebody for 30 years, it's really tough to construct a new life. You've got to figure out how to go out by yourself, not as part of a couple, how to meet new people, how to take up new activities. If you're a woman who hasn't had a career, then it's worst of all because there's very little continuity. You saw everything through the lens of the couple. So you have to find a new life. And that's hard. And so thinking about the ex all the time, getting a lawyer to punish the ex all the time, these things are easy. And if you live in the past for 20 years, you haven't really accomplished anything, but you kind of have this easy slide into feeling irrationally that you've accomplished something. So that's the intimate realm. In the workplace, I just think you just have to blow off a lot of this and just not get upset, period. And there I am, much more of a stoic. I just think when some colleague makes some rude remark, you could go crazy if you paid attention to every rude remark somebody makes. Seneca says that at one point, that if the wise man got angry at every violation of social rules, he would indeed go crazy.
You mentioned several times that there are, of course, classes of things that are genuinely objectionable. And you started off saying that there are real legitimate wrongs that people get angry at. And what we've been talking about now, it seems to be pretty easy to say, well, there's something wrong with my own attitude. They're not worthy of being so concerned with to raise my anger. So there's a kind of self-training that would be involved with it. And even for something that might even be a betrayal or something like that, seems like, yeah, it's going to be harder to do, but it involves a kind of self-work. But I've been thinking about questions that give rise to anger that might just involve fairness. And maybe that falls into the realm of justice, but within a community or a neighborhood, you have economic wrongs that could be genuine economic wrongs, or they could be economic imbalances that result in anger. Maybe it has its root in jealousy, but it's not so clear to me that they are remedied by self-work.
No, certainly not. And this is where the humanities are a really helpful image, because what they basically say is, we turn these important things over to the law. We don't have to follow them up in our own psyches because we invent legal systems that have the job of dealing with those important wrongs, and they should do so in a spirit of forward-looking welfare. They should, that is, take up whatever attitude toward punishment is dictated by general forward-looking concerns, trying to really make a difference. So we might punish for reasons of incapacitation, we might punish for reasons of specific deterrence, general deterrence, or, where that's possible, reform. But there's no point in the pure payback doesn't get you anything. So we turn things over to the law. And that means that if I have a student, let's say, who's been sexually harassed in the workplace, and that often, unfortunately, happens, I will right away, in fact, I am required to do so, report it to the Title IX coordinator. The Title IX coordinator will deal with the complaint and with the person and with the accused and somehow or other achieve a fair result. But of course, that should be in a spirit of what is the way of dealing with that very serious violation that's going to do good going forward. Now, I happen to think that sexual harassment is among the most deterrable of crimes. I think that most men, once they understand what the rule is and they understand what's wrong with their behavior, if they're not psychopaths, they will conform their behavior to the rule. So having a rule and making sure that you mean it, that there's real accountability, is good mostly for reasons of deterrence. And we can see that while laws against underage drinking do absolutely no good and no one is deterred. Laws against sexual harassment have done a lot of good because the people who are now charged rightly with that are usually very troubled people who are probably, for psychological reasons, not so deterrable. But in any case, we turn things over to the law. And I think that's very important because these problems are hard to solve. And you don't solve it just by taking personal retaliation. And indeed, you don't solve it only by punishing either, because if a society waits around for men to harass women and then whaps them when they do, that would be very stupid because you want to educate beforehand. You want to try to do whatever is possible to prevent the crime from taking place. And that's true of all sorts of crimes. So one group that I admire is the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, because instead of just thinking I'm going to go out and kill all these drunk drivers or try to get the toughest sentence in court for each of them to inflict maximum suffering, they did this very intelligent thing. They want now cars to be equipped with breathalyzer devices so you can't start your car. If you have, let's say, one drunk driving conviction, you now have to have one of these devices. Before you can start your car, you have to blow into a tube. So of course, ex-ante deterrence is much better than ex-post deterrence because now that car doesn't start and the person isn't going to be killed. And more generally, if a society is really serious about crime, what it would do is think, what is it that causes people to commit various crimes? Is it lack of education? Is it lack of employment opportunities? Is it poverty? Is it bad nutrition? And then they would put in place a complicated program of education and social welfare aimed at making less crime ex ante. Now then, of course, some crime will still occur, and then you deal with it in the way that I said. But the most important thing is that you don't just wait around for somebody to inflict suffering on. You try to figure out what to do about the whole problem.
A lot of people take it for granted that you see an injustice and the proper response is outrage, and in many cases, public declarations of outrage. And that sort of seems to more and more dominate public discourse. You know, you start a Twitter hashtag or you write some sort of screed online.
Well, outrage, I want to stop here because that word is a little bit slippery, and there's a sense of outrage in which I think outrage is perfectly rational. That is where you're saying, this is really, really wrong, really, really bad. Let's commit ourselves to making sure that doesn't happen again. And we could even be quite emotional about that. And that's a special kind of emotion, and I think it's on the borderline of anger. I don't really care whether we call it a species of anger or not, but it's a kind of quasi-anger. And I call it transition anger because it's anger that's already focused on solving the problem in the future. So it doesn't say, let's pay back the offender. It drops that part, but instead it says, let's make sure this doesn't happen again. So I think some outrage that you see in public life today is like that. But it's very hard to disentangle it from the payback kind. I think if you looked at followers of Bernie Sanders, you'd find many people of goodwill who really want to solve our society's problems, and they're using outrage to promote a rethinking of our economic policies and so forth. But then there are many who just want to take revenge. They want to pay back the bankers, smash the system. And growing up in just such a revolutionary movement at the time of the SDS and the anti-war movement, I saw the double face, because indeed there were some people in that who really had this forward-looking constructive view, but then there were others who just really wanted to smash the system.
And I think you point this out in your book, even in cases where we think we're engaged in sort of transitional anger towards something constructive, there's a large capacity for self-deception in that. And, you know, this made me think of Nietzschean resentment, sort of unconscious desire for revenge underlying some seemingly moral comportment to the world.
Yeah, unfortunately. And indeed, that, I think, means that you really should deliberate and examine yourself a lot. Nelson Mandela says he used 27 years in prison on Robben Island to examine himself and get rid of his desire for payback. Well, we don't all, thank God, have that kind of solitude. But King thought that we just engage in a kind of group process that he called self-purification. And that just meant, you know, let's talk about what we're really feeling, talk about why we're doing what we're doing, and let's drop the payback thing and move toward constructive work. And so it doesn't have to take 27 years.
Did you follow the Stanford rape case at all?
Yeah, I did.
And so just because it happened so recently, I'm thinking of that in this discussion, because the case was part of the judicial system went through.
Right, right.
And then the response by the victim to basically complain about the verdict.
Right.
I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that in the context of anger and political justice and outrage, the way you were just talking about it. One interpretation might be, well, look, she expressed outrage at a systematic miscarriage of justice.
It was also a victim statement at the trial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, those things in our culture are very, very valuable because there's still a deficiency of accountability. I wrote a piece on Huffington Post, I don't know if you saw it, about actors and athletes being above the law. And I described an incident from my own past with a well-known actor where it was perfectly clear that that person, I mean, I didn't pursue criminal charges just because I knew at that time and place, especially that that person would have just walked all over me and no one would care and no one would believe me. But anyway, so whenever people regard themselves as above the law and think that they can do whatever they want to do, and I'm afraid that's particularly true right now of athletes and actors, but particularly athletes like Bill Cosby has made the actors a little more like normal people. You know, it's not true anymore of politicians. Politicians used to be above the law, but they're not above the law now. But so we're creeping ahead. But where we have these people in whose talents a lot of money has been invested, somebody like Jameis Winston, for example, and they twist the judicial process. And so not because I think that there's any notion of the right proportional punishment, but rather for reasons of forward-looking deterrence, I think the sentence given in that case was very, very unfortunate. And it would be right to protest that because we want the message sent to young men that even if you're a star athlete, you're not above the law. You have to treat women with respect. And if you come upon a woman who's drunk, it's not okay to go ahead. So the signal that that judge was sending was this horribly corrupt signal saying, well, if your talents are worth a lot of money to big investors, then you just are above everyone else. And that, I think, is the real problem in that case.
Can we maybe clarify the relation between the normal justice case and the revolutionary justice case, since you have two different chapters on them, that we've sort of been blurring them together as we've been talking about them here, that, you know, if something serious enough is done to you, you've talked about two ways to deflect, to remove yourself from personal anger. One is just deal with the loss, deal with the grief, but turn the retribution or, you know, what's going to happen next over to the state. But then, well, what if the state's laws aren't just? What if you live in a fundamentally unjust society or even just one like we're talking about here that there are gaps in it? Well, then you could, instead of just leaving it to the state, you have to enter into some political activism, maybe find other people that have been in a similar situation, get some sort of, you know, raise consciousness, get some sort of movement going, try to change the law. Do you want to say more about the relationship between those two enterprises?
Well, I think, yeah, it's very tricky because, of course, there's always the question, what are you doing with your life? And I mean, just to stick with the ordinary justice with gaps for a minute, I think that somebody who's in a situation of being a victim always has a lot of choices. And I end up counseling students who have been victims of sexual assault or sexual harassment. And the question for them always is, how do I want to spend the next 3 years of my life? Do I really want to get wrapped up in the system? Which is, of course, good for other women. It's good for society going forward. But maybe for me, it's not so good. And I have to finish my papers by the deadline. Now, what I thought back in 1968, when this event that I described in Huffington Post happened to me, was I would accomplish nothing by going to the police. They would not believe me. They would believe the powerful actor. And I would, you know, work and work. And I might have ruined my graduate school career because I was about to go to graduate school. I would have wasted large chunks of my life. So you have to weigh the costs and benefits. And if the benefits are likely so low, as in that case they clearly were, then you just don't want to get into that. Now, I also had another choice much later when that same actor was running for important political office. And that was much, much later. It was like 1990. It was in the middle 90s anyway. And again, I thought, well, you know, enough is enough. It's fine for him to go about his business in Hollywood, but to actually be an important political elected official, that seems too much. But then everyone said to me, well, you know, people will think you're doing it in order to extort money. That was certainly true. A lot of people will think that. And of course, it's sometimes true. And that's why it's so tricky. And they will just not believe you after so many years. All the evidence evidence is gone and so on. And you will end up being charged and no doubt sued for defamation. You will end up again wasting a couple of years of your life and a lot of your social capital. So in the end, I decided not to say anything even then. Now, note that I did finally say something, because I do think things like that should be stated, and women should be able to know that this bad behavior happens and that we need to hold these famous people accountable. But I did it after the guy was dead. And you could call me a coward, okay, because I waited that long. On the other hand, I think for me, I did the right thing. I would not have stood up to like 3 years of being sued for defamation by this guy and so on. You know, so there are those choices. Now, then there's the larger question of how we're going to fix the system. I do think that that requires the help of many people, not just the victims, that all women should stand up and protest when sexual harassment is going on and sexual violence is going on. I'm now a signer of an open letter that has been posted publicly about an individual in the profession who seems to have violated key norms of sexual harassment. And, you know, several hundred philosophers signed this in order to say, we object to that conduct and we want a profession in which that doesn't happen. And so it's not so much about wanting to penalize that guy or make him suffer. I really don't care whether he suffers or not. I think he's probably a very troubled individual who's suffering a lot already. But it's about making a statement. We don't want to have that kind of world. And I think that's what you do when there are big gaps. But when the whole society is corrupt, then you need much more. You need a whole social movement. And I think that's true of the civil rights movement, even though we didn't exactly topple the U.S. Constitution, but the civil rights movement made a huge difference in the way that our laws and institutions were interpreted by the courts. And also, of course, it led to the passing of new statutes that otherwise would not have passed. So that's what you do when something of the society is sound, but a lot of it is rotten. You have a huge social movement that needs the investment of millions of people in order to get that done. And then, so we move from there to the cases of India and South Africa, where we really had to change the whole society in a very sweeping way. Now, South Africa, a lot of the same people stayed, but you got to have a new constitution, a whole new set of political institutions. So Mandela's movement was trying to bring about social change of a very radical sort that involved getting included the 90% of people who had been politically excluded. Gandhi's movement was even more radical. It meant like throwing out the rulers who had been ruling India for close to 200 years. So you have to have, in those cases, mass movements. Also, I would say both are interesting because they invest a lot of their energy in political theater that brings their movement to the attention of the world. I think that was true with King to some degree, but it's much more true of Gandhi and Mandela because they thought their own country wasn't enough, but it was the attention they could get on the world stage that would really propel their movement forward. And so they devoted a lot of attention to how should we present Indian people, Indian men, Indian masculinity, so that the world will see that we're not brutish savages, as I'm afraid the great John Stuart Mill tended to believe, but that actually rational people who are more self-controlled and more rational than the British. And in the case of Mandela, it's very similar. How do we show that black men are not savages, so that the world will support us and trust us and join in the movement for genuine democracy?
Okay, that's the end of part one. Come back next week for part two to hear the tail end of our interview with Martha, where we talk more about social justice, about forgiveness. And this episode is actually going to have a part three, where Dylan, Wes, and I continue to discuss the book, reflecting back on our interview. But you actually don't have to wait for these two parts. You can become a Partially Examined Life citizen at partiallyexaminedlife.com and get the entire unbroken, ad-free edition of the episode either from the citizen portion of our website or beam straight to your mobile device via our convenient citizen feed. Now, as an extra incentive this time, we're going to have a drawing. We're going to give away 4 copies of Martha's book. We're going to do the drawing on August 18th. So after part two comes out, before part three comes out, so we can announce on part three who the winners are, two of these copies are going to be given away via a drawing among the PEL citizenry. It's about 1,000 people right now. It's not terrible odds as drawings go. We're going to try to do this kind of thing periodically to thank folks who have become and remain PEL citizens. The recipient of the third copy will be drawn solely from people who become Partially Examined Life citizens between the release of this episode, that is August 1st, and the day of the drawing. So if you've been thinking about becoming a Partially Examined Life citizen, this is the time. There are really not going to be that many people who do it. Your odds of winning this are going to be excellent as drawings go. Finally, the fourth copy we're going to give away by selecting among the group of people who go on Facebook on the Partially Examined Life Facebook page, who like the page and then like this particular episode to share it to their friends. And of course, if you do that thing on Facebook and become a Partially Examined Life citizen, you will be in the drawing for all four of them, making your odds even better. All right, thanks everybody.